thank you for the invite to be here and to be able to share with you what we see in the agricultural supply chain. I think the two previous talks from Mike and being able to develop some new nutrient flows, how do they actually get to the customer? And a lot of things that Kish talked about was about the whole agricultural productivity. And it's going to be important as we begin to look at supply chain balance around the world of how do we bring that into the market? How do we make these things real? I had a great opportunity to work at Cargill, and Cargill is involved in moving grains and foods around the world and being able to be part of the on-farm production support. So I'm going to talk to you about, I'm going to divide my talk into two pieces. The first is going to be around the high-level supply chains. How does Cargill interact with its food customers? How does it bring products through? How are we divided as a business? And then I want to move into a little bit more specific product scope is around bringing the specialty canola oils into the marketplace and what it took to be able to do that. So you can see a much more integrated approach. I think what's important is that we begin to consider a supply chain not just as grain movement, but from the beginning of trait biology, where we're beginning to look at genes, how we're putting them into plants, how we're building a foundation of crop architecture to be able to have high yields and to be able to supply that food into on-farm, and then bring that from the farm all the way through the agricultural system to be able to process and handle it, manage food safety and food security. I think Kish talked upon what happened in 2006 when the world went crazy about agricultural products. There wasn't enough supply and demand around the world. So how do we create those supply chains for the future products as well as our existing products to be able to get there? So in the global supply of food, the regions of the world are now interconnected. There is no longer a regional production base. Things that are produced here in the United States are exported everywhere. Things in China are exported back to the United States. South America is exported to the United States, to Europe, to China, to Australia. So we're totally interconnected as an agricultural supply chain. At Cargill, we help bring food and agricultural and risk management to our customers to be able to meet their needs in various types of products and services that help them establish it. You know, we started back in 1865. We were an agricultural company. But over 145 years, the dynamic changes that have occurred in agriculture have required us to become an agribusiness. An agribusiness which then focuses on these different parts of the agricultural supply chain. We work in 67 different countries around the world. We have over 150,000 employees involved in agriculture, working with the various types of trait companies, grain handling companies, processing groups. We have about 1,000 locations, which are the points of our food supply around the world. So again, just looking at the broad base there, when you want to begin to move and think about agriculture on a large scale, it requires a lot of different assets around the world and supply chain pieces to get there. At the end of the day, it's our job to bring the world the food through our customers to be able to create the right types of nutrition out there for people. So if you look at our businesses, they're divided into four quadrants, and it's helpful for you to understand, really, this is how we look at the agricultural markets. Agriculture itself is, we look at this, our businesses here originate the basic genetics and grain from the farmer. So the farm production is originated, and then it is brought to the supply chain where it is crushed, and it is converted into an ingredient that is then moved into the food group. The food group is who's taking the ingredients and actually further processing or manufacturing them to extract the micronutrients or the macronutrients that are needed to be able to create the right food formulations with our customers. So we're supplying those ingredients that our customers need out there, and we're working in both in the food ingredient area and the beverage area. We also have a significant part of our businesses that are in animal feeds and animal proteins. So how do we supply the nutrients that go into those animals to be able to increase productivity, but at the same time to do this in a sustainable way to be able to manage the entire food supply chain cost effectively for our customers at the end of the day and do it in an environmentally correct way? Another part of the supply chain is risk management, and that's in our financial services group. Companies need to understand how the supply chain is working and also to be able to manage their costs throughout the world because there's fluctuations in the market. Since we're supplying seed out of the United States and it's going to China, prices could fluctuate based on purchases that occur daily in that rate. And so to be able to manage the overall cost so that we as consumers in whatever world we live in is maintained at a specific price so we don't have price hikes, the financial management group is managing the risk for the specific customers. So it's important that for any company, food company today, is to be able to correctly manage its equity position in such a dynamic and changing economy that we live in. And then in the industrial area, I have biofuels up here, but it's really bio-based businesses. I'll get into on my next slide a little bit more detail about that, but it's really a range of ingredients that come out of plant sciences. So not only things that go into human food, but also things that go into animal food and other bio-based products that we use daily in our lives. Our customers are, I divided them into two groups. We have our food and beverage customers, and these are people who make the primary food and beverage products. So you, in here you would see people like General Mills, Unilever, Nestle, who are making many of the products that you buy in the supermarkets today. But also you'll have Coca-Cola. And Ernesto is going to talk a little bit later about some things at Coke. But again, we supply Coke with various types of sugars and flavor components that make the wonderful drinks and beverages that they sell to us as consumers throughout the world. We also have then the food service group. And so this is, when we talk about food service, this is when you go out to a restaurant to eat. That's the food service industry. There's a number of different types of food products that go out there. In our fast-paced life today, we spend a lot of time in the food service arena. So a McDonald's, a Wendy's, across the street there's California Pizza Kitchens. All of those are using the products of agriculture, and they're being assembled in a way that creates a nutritious meal for you to be able to go on the go and to be able to eat wherever you are around the world and do it in a cost-effective manner. And you can begin to see food service globalizing around the world. Okay, so while McDonald's started here, and there's some 15,000 stores in North America, there's 1,500 in China. And China, potentially with its growth, will increase. But what it's doing is creating a food supply to people who couldn't access that before. And so you'll see a continual expansion of the food service markets throughout the world, but it's really based out of the crops and things that we produce. And these companies are looking for better nutrition. So again, the things that Mike talked about, these are great ways to be able to deliver them in a very accessible way. And in the retail and consumer markets, we play where we're providing, again, manufacturer-specific products that are being sold in the over-the-counter, as well as in some countries, Cargill actually is in the process of selling directly to consumers, whether it's bottled oil or whether it's meat. We have those types of businesses in different parts of the world. The industrial area is pretty complex, so it's, instead of just having four, you can see the very, very different areas in which we sell products to. But I think some of the areas that are of interest are personal care, some of the products that we make, how do they come back to us and how do we use them at home, pet care, pharmaceuticals, de-icing. Fertilizer is probably one that really ramifies throughout what we do in agriculture. How do we supply and manage fertilizers with our producers and do that effectively? And then I think at the end is really sustainable packaging. So how do we move into using some of the byproducts that come out of corn or soybeans to be able to make a packaging product, the things that we buy in the supermarkets or in the fast food restaurants, to be able to recycle that quickly and be biodegradable and sustainable. So at a high level, we help manage our customer supply chain. And because of our global positioning, and again, any of the agri-food businesses would be in the same position that you see today, but it's knowing how is the grain flowing. Where are the shortages around the world to be able to make sure that we can produce or move grain rapidly into those areas so there isn't famine or a part where people are not going to be able to eat. We also have to help our customers understand how to source grain from different parts of the world and be able to bring that effectively into their processing plants on a timely manner. We also know when there are droughts and there's occurrences around the world where we may not meet quality. And so we have to be able to meet the quality products, and so we could source from different global arenas to be able to make sure that we're meeting the functionality of the food product we want. And then we work in the supply chain, so our active involvement in being able to source grains and be able to source oil seeds for end product utilization allows us better knowledge there to work with our customer in managing their supply chain. Regional transportation and storage. If you think about how many boats are there that are moving oils back and forth between Asia or between South America and the United States? All these have to be managed in a way into the ports and then move from the ports onto the rail cars and then into the processing plants and from the processing plants back over to our end users. So again, it's a complex supply chain of which our customers expect us to manage not only the cost, but also the timely delivery and the food safety. Food security is one of the biggest issues today in the world, and making sure that in all the transportation and the processing of ingredients, we do that in a safe, sound way. Once we process the food ingredients, there's a lot of processing technologies that are out there on how you can modify, whether it's corn, to be able to get it into some of its 96 different forms before it goes into a food product, or whether it's an oil and how you can make a shortening or you can deliver a liquid oil. These are all key assets that we work with to be able to work with customers and manage that for them. So there has to be discrete at plant locations where there's separate piping, separate tanks, separate trucks to all manage this oil supply. And then to be able to store that and maintain the stability of the oil, again, you know, Kish talked a little bit about, you know, the change and the revolution of moving from high ALA products to low ALA products, and that was a switch to move out of trans fatty acids. We were hydrogenating a lot of our oils in the United States, and today there's probably less than 20% of the oil is hydrogenated, where at one time it was close to 90% of the oil was hydrogenated. Hydrogenated to be able to create stability and also to create functionality. So today we have to have new systems that we had to innovate since 2005 to be able to manage that supply chain and deliver it into the customer's hands so that it is not rancid and so it can be used in that product. Then the other part is the financial supply chain. Working with our customers to better understand supply chain costs. Again, why do we have such low food costs in the United States? A lot of it is how we handle and manage food. We reduce waste in every place that we can. We create efficiencies in how products are moved. We reduce the amount of waste. And so by being able to show a customer how he can source from one processing plant or a multitude of plants to be able to deliver into his plant and reduce the cost helps him to have or maintain a better price. Supply chain product flows. So throughout the course of a product, it doesn't always stay the same. So if wheat production, for example, in Kansas didn't meet specifications, we may move some wheat over from Oklahoma or move it from Colorado and be able to create the right blend to be able to get there. And so again, it's understanding the crop supply and then being able to readjust the whole grain flow to be able to still meet the needs of the end user at the end of the day. And then, of course, always looking at optimization. And again, in the global world, there's always dynamic changes. There's always purchases of different elevators, of different transport companies, and so we want to manage that. So again, at the end, what I say is to be able to work in this world, we help our customers manage that entire supply chain, which has considerable complexity. So far I've talked about, just at a very high level, the complexities that you see in being able to handle and move grain around, the importance of risk management. Now, what happens when you have 8 different businesses in Cargill, 8 different ingredients with a lot of depth and knowledge like that, and then you have customers you have to deliver it to? Well, for a number of years, we've continued to look at ourselves as individual businesses. I work in the oils and shortening business, but my associates are in cocoa, texturizers, starches, flours, health and nutrition, malt, and flavor systems. And so when we would go to a customer, we would go as individuals, and we would create massive supply chains to be able to deliver products and not coordinate it into the end user's plants. And so what we've been able to do is to take a more integrated approach and be able to look where there's opportunities that we can work cross-functionally as customer teams to target specific areas. And so we build in our food science teams the depth of knowledge to be able to understand a customer if they're in the bakery segment, the people that come from cocoa and oils and shortening and texturizers and flour and potentially flavor systems work together to understand what is it that we can deliver, how can we deliver it, how can we manufacture it to be able to meet a product specification or a new formulation for the customer in the bakery segment. So moving into the customer's world creates a new supply chain dynamic that we didn't have before. It also creates an efficiency for the end user. And so being able to map all these pieces out and deliver them effectively in a cost-effective manner is what we've been able to do. And so, again, the beverage area, the confections. In the confection area, what we're looking at, say, we have a company that makes malted milk balls. I happen to like those. And so we would take malt from our malting group. We would take flavors from our flavor systems. We would take starches and sweeteners and combine that. And, of course, the coating on the outside comes from oils and shortening. We're creating a chocolate that doesn't melt. But, again, it's a desire of what people want to eat, and so we create those products that are there. So, again, complexity in food science. So when you look at customers, customers are always deciding, how do I change my brand? How do I protect it? Or how do I evolve it to where consumers want to be? And again, this goes all the way back to what's available from our grain and oil delivery system. So again, what are the ingredients that are available? Where is it that they want to go? And so somewhere in the world, this is going to meet. So what you look at, as I've put convenience, flavor variety, indulgence, consumer wellness, and organic foods. So these are just some of the dynamic changes that you'd see. And I think in the convenience area, because of our mobile work life, we want to work, we go to exercise, we go do things, we're eating on the go. And so we're continually looking for something that's very portable. It carries energy density, carries the right amount of protein, but again, minimizes the amount of sugars that we're consuming. And so, again, a whole new packaging design around this has to occur because it has to come fresh, regardless if we throw it in our briefcase, we leave it in the car. All the environment around that is going to affect the quality of that product. So, again, how do we source the right sugar, the right flour, the right oil to be able to put into that change? So, again, the continual changes that our customers make drive back to how we pull into the supply chain different ingredient products, or we go back and innovate new types of products. I think flavor variety is pretty unique in that here we're looking at, with the demographics changing in the United States, people are looking for different flavors. We're looking for more robust flavors, things which are back from our home countries. We're looking for Asian taste. We're looking for bursts of heat that we hadn't had before. And so, again, this requires a whole new system of flavors, but also how do we carry them onto the food? So it may be different types of texturants. And then extrusion technology changes because people are familiar with certain types of shapes of foods. We want to extrude those foods. So to make that, we can no longer use the same flour base as we used before. So we go back and design new starches or extraction techniques that then allow us to be able to make these extruded products. Let's talk about consumer wellness and functional foods, because I think the last two speakers really were focusing on how do we improve human health, how do we do this dynamically. And so there's a tremendous move by our customers to look at wellness. And what is it that we can deliver in our food products that enhance health or correct some of the problems that we've had by overeating through obesity, cardiovascular diseases. And so we're looking at ways to do weight management. How do we reduce calories? How do we manage disease by putting in the right micronutrients or the right omega-3 fatty acids to be able to improve heart disease, and then create a positive nutrition package. So more and more as you go through your supermarkets, you're beginning to see these types of food products replace some of the old brands that are there and begin to gain more and more market share. 10 years ago, this was in a separate aisle by itself, and most of the major supermarkets today just have major sections of the store that are devoted to consumer wellness and functional foods. So at a very high level, I've shared with you kind of the complexity of the food chains. As you begin to look at from the sourcing of the product all the way through to the delivery of the food at the end of the day, we have to consider what's happening with the global markets. We have to be able to look at how do we source different grains upon needs because of shortages in certain areas or because of different qualities that we need. How do we take oil seeds and how do we bring in different sunflower, Hialeic Sun, New Sun? We look at soybean oil, we're coming to market in the future with Hialeic soybean oil, which is one of the innovations that have come out of the Monsanto team. Again, dynamics that continue to change. How do we source and how do we manage that supply to be able to get to our customer? Risk management every day. There's trading that's going on and managing risk to be able to make sure that the supply chain is secure and food products are filling that supply chain through. And I think the innovation and continued reformulation, this has been ongoing. and it will continue to go on, particularly with the wave of health that we're going to see coming in the future, and the recognition by people like you that there are micronutrients that we can develop and put into our food crops. This will be a new source for us to be able to put forward. So leaving that at the macro scale, let me get into working and sharing with you what it took as we look in the oil seed space to develop a new plant oil. What does it take to be able to create that supply chain? So the things we talk about when we invest in technology, we have to invest and think about what's the market going to be 7 or 8 years from today? Because the transgenic methods, the plant breeding methods, the genomic methods, they all speed us up to where we need to go, but there's a period of discovery and investment to get there. We have to make sure we choose the right choices and invest our money wisely to those things that will have the greatest benefit in the marketplace. And like we've seen in the previous talks, globalization is driving obesity. Kish said 2 in 1, that 1 out of every 2 children in China are obese. In the United States, 26% of our children are obese. 42% of the adults are obese. So this is a pandemic issue in the world. And because of globalization, the world, you know, we'll hear Friedman talk a little bit later about the world being flat, about the acceleration of exchange of cultures and ideas. It's not going to stop. So it's going to keep going, and it'll have its ramifications throughout. What we find is our exercise time, our free time, because of the hectic pace at which we live, we no longer have time to do the fitness thing. Okay, we do it either early in the morning. So then how do we take healthy foods in to be able to better manage our overall weight and be able to manage our health? While doing minimal type of exercise. I believe you said, Kish, that in 1900 there was a large number of the workforce, 50% or more of the world today is in agriculture, and you can see the dynamic changes. That was physical fitness being in agriculture. Today, when we sit at our laptops or do that work, we no longer have that exercise that our bodies were built for and selected for. Obesity is driving major diabetes, hypertension, and heart attack and stroke. We are going to see these increase as long as we stay on the path of where we are. We need better nutrition in the United States and in the world. We need to recognize, we need to teach people, but we also need to provide them with the foods that can correct some of these problems. Families will be harnessed with multiple diseases with their children, with themselves, and as children age, I mean, they are obese today, when they're 40, they will carry these major diseases with them. What will happen to our healthcare system? How will we pay for that? How will we manage the systems with better foods? So food companies are going to be developing products that are targeted toward reducing specific risk profiles. So you'll see better you'll see encapsulation of micronutrients that'll be delivered in drinks. They'll be in bars as we eat them. We'll reduce the total amount of fat that's in our products. And probably long-term, fried snacks, fried food products and snacks are going to become indulgent items. This hurts my bottom line because I'm in the oil business. And you know, it's great because a lot of the products, when you go to the quick serve restaurants, are fried. But there's an evolution of what's happening with those products. 10 years from now, you're not going to see the French fries manufactured as they are today. Potato chips will no longer look the same. Yet we will eat them because we like them. They were indulgent, but they're going to be healthier for us, and we'll be able to manage that within our weight class. So the future, when you look at what's happening, reduction of calories is paramount. So it's just in the foods we sell, but also in how we manage our own diet. Reduction of salt, it's happening. We've already seen 25% reduction in salt out of most of the products in the United States today. That is going to be ongoing. Reduction of carbs, so again, how do we replace specific carbohydrates with fiber? Reduction of saturates and trans fats. A lot of the trans fats are already done, but there's a continual push to reduce the amount of total saturates that are in our diet. We see increased fiber. If you look at the Kellogg's product lines, fiber is the number one ingredient that they've added over the last 5 years that has created a positive health benefit as well as antioxidants into there. We'll be increasing protein contents of food products, so again, more energy density, better product absorption. And then specific additives like sterol esters, omega-3 fatty acids will be added for heart health, and many of the things that Mike and Kish talked about you also see as they become online and available will be supplied. So what's driving in the North American market? So if I look to invest, local and state governments are moving to ban trans fats in food service. New York City, California, probably Chicago is next. You will not have trans fats served to people at all moving forward. It just will, and they're doing it because of the health of the people, as well as the cost of managing their health care systems. The 2010 dietary American the Dietary Guidelines for America have been released from the USDA, and these are recommendations. They're not approved yet. They're up for approval in December. But two of the things I want to enforce that they've told us is reducing the daily value for saturated fat. Today is 10%. They want to move it to 5 to 7%. Significant reduction in saturated fats in the products we eat. So if you go read the labels of the nutrient panel, you'd be surprised how much you eat every day in saturated fat. So read your nutrient labels and understand what you consume. Increase the amount of omega-3 fatty acids in your diet. And they recommend to do this through fish consumption. Two servings per week, 250 milligrams of omega-3 per serving. First of all, the problem with that is that most people in the United States don't have access to be able or afford to eat fish. Okay? A lot of the fish that we get, it's not rich in omega-3 fatty acids because it comes out of fish farms. So what are we going to do? We need to be able to find other ways to put in DHA and EPA into plant products that then can be consumed or increase, at least in the beginning, the amount of ALA in food products that can then be naturally converted in our bodies to the long-chain omega-3. Inefficient, but at least it will be part of that process. And then there's voluntary changes that are occurring. We're already seeing most of the food manufacturers following the Children and Food Beverage Marketing Initiative to reduce the amount of marketing to children. And then the grocery manufacturers came out, I believe, last week about front of the package initiative, labeling amount of sodium, the amount of saturates, the amount of carbohydrates. Very clear, very simple for people to read on a number basis that they can add up on a serving size for that package. So again, these are the trends. So if I were to think about what do I want to develop, I'm interested in making sure that my food products or my ingredients that I sell have zero trans, have a reduction in saturates, have an increase in omega-3 fatty acids. Okay. So let's think about then creating that supply chain. So I always want to start with the end. I've told you about the market. So that's what we want to drive for. And so while the marketing is at the end of this supply chain, this assured supply chain, it is actually the beginning to give us the direction. That tells seed R&D where to work. And so with starting that end goal in mind, seed R&D will go out and source the traits and begin to build the platform to be able to deliver the oil at the end of the day. Breeding is about increasing yield to be able to stack agronomic traits and be able to do it in an effective manner so that there is no yield penalty. Because at the end of the day, a grower wants to be compensated if the yield isn't there. If we have to compensate a grower for yield beyond an identity preservation premium, it's going to show up in the food product, which is going to be cost to the consumer, in which most consumers will say, I buy the cheap product rather than buy something for health. We're just not at that stage today in our thinking to be able to pay more. And then how do we scale this up for certified seed production? Again, managing these traits through a identity preserved system, they have to be able to express themselves in the seed. They have to be pure, because otherwise you'll just be producing half and half and half, and by the time it gets into the processing plant, the product quality will not be there. Because of identity preservation and scaling up to meet specific needs, we do contract production. So we actually work with producers and be able to contract the crop to be able to get the right volumes, the right quality, and the education that's there. And then from the contract, the delivery system goes into our crush plants. So a grower is set up on specific delivery windows to be able to supply the seed into the plant and be able to deliver it, and there's a quality control check at that spot to be able to manage that quality. If it doesn't have the quality at the delivery point, then it's rejected. But you really cannot accept loads that are out of spec because it will deteriorate the full quality of the product, particularly when you're looking at metabolites. They have to be at specific levels. And then our refining processes. Okay, what comes into the crush plant? Oil has to move into the refining plants to be able to make the final oil quality that's going to be delivered to the customer at the end of the day. So being able to understand all the oil that's being outsourced at that plant, how the customers are going to be having it delivered, tells us the whole flow through all the way from the production end through the crush to the refining to the customer. And then in here, we have to work with our customers to be able to develop the application expertise of being able to use these new products. So new-to-the-world products require new-to-the-world solutions and handling systems in pilot plants first, in product testing in stores, and then finally in the final manufacturing process. So our tech service teams, our food application teams, and our R&D teams are brought together in the food science area to be able to do this. Also, just think about how you refine or extract this product requires engineers to be able to do the changes in processing to be able to get to that end point. And at the end, you have an oil. And typically, a customer does not use a straight oil, but uses a blended oil. The oil is blended to meet specific functionality requirements, specific flavors, specific stability needs. And so, again, all this is put together to be able to create that the right oil that makes the right functionality in your food product at the end of the day. And then it has to be packaged. Some customers take stuff in rail cars, and so we fill up rail cars and we ship them to their manufacturing plants. Other customers take things in drums because they're smaller manufacturers, and some take them in jibs, which are just a jug in the box, and they use it in their store. So again, being able to understand the type of packaging, being able to make it work for them in their processes and in their part, and then again, we end up with marketing and sales to be able to continue to move the products through, and then our distribution system and warehousing system to manage quality control. That's the complete supply chain, all the way from understanding the market, developing it from the seed trait, and then delivering it to the customer at the end of the day. A lot of complexity along the way. So I'm not going to spend a lot of detail, but just to move through, we start with the gene. And like Kish said, a gene taken out of a different plant can have a different response. It can have a different yield profile. What's going to be important for us is to be able to say, how do we select those genes and put them into plants, whether it's a GMO-based trait or whether it's a traditional plant breeding trait, and to be able to get it to be stabilized and to be able to be managed. So there's a lot of orchestration that has to occur, a lot of selection of different traits to be able to give us that point of stability. We then design the genetic package. We build tools for genomics to be able to quickly upload these traits and be able to manage them all the way through the supply chain. You have to make sure that the genes are there in the breeding process and in the seed production point to make sure that the quality is going to meet when the products are extracted. So genomics become a really major role in being able to understand all this. And genes are not simple in canola. It's an amphidiploid, so it has multiple gene copies, different expression levels. So we've got to figure out which ones and what combination give us the product we want at the end of the day. And then understanding the impact on the yield performance, but then is there a regulatory need? So if it's a GM trait, of course, we have to go through a deregulation process not only in North America, but in global supply. We can not produce just a product here and not somewhere else. So again, the ability for us to deregulate products in a more simpler way would allow more products to come forward to effectively meet our food and nutrient demands. At the end of the day, we have a trait package that's provided to a breeder, and breeders do a lot of amazing things. When I started back in 1980s, biotechnology was just coming online, and what we said was, we don't need plant breeders anymore. Well, little did they know that it's still taken 25, 30 years, and we still need plant breeders. Plant breeders are amazing people who can combine traits, yield, disease packages, nutrient uptake packages, all into a crop that a grower wants to grow on his field. And so they do all their magic to be able to create this. They use biotechnology to make dihaploids. They do selection processes out in the fields. They use genomics to be able to test things. Breeding today is very different than what breeding was 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 50 years ago. The world is continuing to change, and breeders are continuing to adapt new technology to bring crops to us sooner and faster. It is amazing to see what we can do with our crops today. But we still run trials. It still takes 4 years from the time you've uploaded a trait to the time you run it through the trialing system to be able to show the G by E, the gene by environment interaction, to make sure your crop will sustain the breadth of environment that will come to us. And I've been breeding canola for 20 years, and I have not seen 1 year that's the same as the last. And so we need to have that breadth of genes that allow us to be stabilized when there's too much water in the field or when it's dry in the field. We still have to assure the supply of the product at the end of the day. So at the end of the, we work here then with biotech companies like Monsanto or Bayer Crop Science to bring in herbicide tolerance where it's necessary. Tremendous evolution in technology, yield gains, managing weeds, but it's too bad it only works in North America. We can't bring these to other countries around the world. The amount of soil fertility and tilth in our soils in Canada and the United States in the canola fields is tremendous today versus when we were using five or six different chemicals and continually passing and tilling over the fields. These technologies really need to be global technologies. And right now we can see Australia is beginning to move. We produce canola in Australia. We produce a non-GMO. But because of the efficiencies, the farmers have been able to convince the bioactivists out in the farmland that the yields are better. Management systems are better. These are very safe practices to be able to use in the field. And so we can begin to see the turning of one major country that produces wheat and canola in the southern hemisphere. So now we have a hybrid, we have it registered, we've worked with government agencies for registration. We understand where we need to produce it. So now the second part of the supply chain comes in. How much do we need to produce? How many acres do we need to contract? So today, for our canola business in North America, for Hiale canolas, we need to contract 1.5 million acres of canola. Well, I can't do that all around one crush plant because it's putting too many eggs in one basket, so I diversify the crop across the entire Canadian production area. And for what you're seeing here is provinces of Manitoba, Saskatchewan, and Alberta, and parts of North Dakota. This is the major canola belt of United States. There's some growing in the south, there's some growing in Idaho, but when you look at the major acreage, it's there in Canada. So understanding how much oil I need works back to how many acres I need to contract, what type of seed production I need to have, and then I have to look at my quality control systems. How is the oil coming out of the farmer's fields? What is the genetic makeup of the seed going into the farmer's fields? These things need to be totally coordinated. Identity preservation systems prevent the crossover of commercial seeds or commodity seeds with our specialty seeds. So we have separate binning, we have separate tags, we have separate containment systems all the way through the crush and refining facilities. And at the end of the day, all this is coordinated with how it's going to be packaged and how it's going to be stored. I touched on a lot of those before, but that's a major part where agronomists spend a lot of their time in the fields with the producers to make sure that we got it right. And at the end of the day, we deliver the customer solution. And so in this case, we delivered Clear Valley 65. It had low linolenic because it created the oxidative stability we needed. We were able to eliminate high trans fat products in fried foods, and we were able then to create a sustainable supply for customers and then be able to take the solution and start producing it globally in different geographies because our customers that are here are also in Australia, in China, in Europe, in South America. So we help our customers in our supply chain needs by being able to provide safe and reliable sources of our food ingredients. Key reason for the supply chain is safety and quality of the food ingredients. And we do that not only for our core ingredients of flour and corn, but we do it with our specialty ingredients and also our ingredient formulations. Working with them in the supply chain of understanding how to formulate the food and how to begin to pull that through the marketplace, a series of pieces that go on. We help them manage risk, which really manages the price to you as the consumer and allows the company to continue to invest to be able to manage their products. And at the end, the supply, making sure that the rail cars come on time, that the boats move across the ocean on time, and that the oil is delivered to their plants on time, so nothing is ever shut down. So I'd like to conclude there and say thank you very much for the opportunity to share with you.